through the use of intellect, man will conquer the earth, will conquer nature, and will himself become God. It's taught in every Masonic temple in this land, every secret brotherhood, every secret society, every mystical temple, every occult organization teaches the Luciferian philosophy.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. As Obama departs and Trump prepares to take over in Washington, both Turkey and the Philippines remove themselves from the US sphere of influence. Are Washington's chickens finally coming home to roost, or is this just due to infighting amongst US elites? Also, another author has brought out a book on the infamous Operation Gladio, where NATO spent decades using fascist cells to blow up European towns and cities in an attempt to drive us into the arms of the Pentagon for protection. His name is US journalist Paul Williams. And our new emperor, Donald Trump, takes over on Friday the 20th of January. He'll be saying goodbye to CIA Director John Brennan, who was interviewed this week by the BBC's Gordon Carrera. Plus, as what looks like it might be a last-minute move by Obama and the Pentagon, 3,600 US tanks are being shipped into Holland and Germany. What's that all about? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, a look at the history of fair rents in the context of the present housing shortage. Also, more about Colombia and our final piece from the English Civil War Museum in Newark. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But first, I'm joined on the line by Andrew Ashdown, Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who's recently returned from Syria. Hi, Reverend Ashdown, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening. Hello.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you first got interested in international affairs? You're obviously not your average local kind of parish vicar.
Well, no. Well, I was brought up in Africa for a start, and since 1982, I've been travelling widely in the Middle East and Africa as well. But over the last 25 years, I've been a regular visitor to the Middle East, particularly Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt. I first went to Syria in 2003 and visited several times prior to the conflict, taking several groups into Syria as well to meet with faith communities there, and have visited the country six times since April 2014, three times, in fact, in 2016, having just returned a few weeks ago. I've been very much interested in the whole region as a place of faith communities and encounter and history and you know, the whole importance of the region on so many levels.
Give us an idea of a sort of paint a picture, if you can, for what Syria was like when you were there back in the early noughties.
Yes, one of the reasons I fell in love with the country was because it was diverse, it was pluralistic, it was actually remarkably peaceful. From a religious and a social point of view, it was actually regarded as one of the beacons of the Middle East. I mean, it was one of the most relaxed in terms of faith communities, in terms of social attitudes and outlooks, and you would see this tremendous diversity. It is one of the most diverse countries in the region, of faith and ethnic communities as well. And of course, I put this very strongly. It was the social and religious aspects that were particularly striking. Of course, there are political issues, which were on a different level as well. But visiting Syria, you would see it as a country of great beauty, of friendly people, of acceptance and tolerance between different communities for the most part. And one that was trying to engage with the people and the outside world as well.
Well, I mean, some have said, haven't they, that actually the President Assad had a kind of feared secret police which was keeping everyone cowering.
Well, yeah, you didn't actually see that. That wasn't the atmosphere you had. Now, I've been in situations in other countries where you had a genuine sense of fear. I think I've got many, many friends in Syria from all different communities. And I've met hundreds of people of different communities. And their message was, if you kept your head down politically, life was fine. And so it wasn't a question of cowering. People would not try not to get involved in politics, but actually on all other levels, life was good. It was one of the sort of freest, in inverted commas, I stress in inverted commas, countries in the whole of the region, where people had a freedom of faith and social attitudes. It was in the political dimension that there wasn't that total freedom. But it wasn't a question of people cowering. And one certainly didn't get that impression when talking to people. People were certainly cautious talking politically. But at the same time, I've been talking with hundreds of people even since 2014, and people are very, very open and candid about their different views and openly critical at times of the government and aspects of the government and so forth. So, no, if you visited Syria, you wouldn't get that sense of cowering and fear, which actually there might be in other places as well.
Okay, what about the difference between the way the Christian faith plays out and the way it is expressed in Syria compared to here in Britain?
Christianity and Islam, I mean, at the heart of Syrian life, I mean, it's really important to recognize that for most Syrians, of whatever faith or whatever community, faith is an essential part of their life, of an essential part of living one's life itself. In Syria, you still see, even now, in the government-controlled areas, you still see mosques and churches side by side. I was there just for Christmas, and actually Muslims and Christians together were celebrating Christmas on the streets and Christmas decorations everywhere, and people going to church or the mosques as they will, as I say, side by side. And that faith has been lived out for centuries, generations. I mean, Christianity was there way before it came to Europe. I mean, it came with St. Paul. I mean, the Melkite Patriarch of Syria says Christ was born in Palestine, but Christianity was born in Syria, and that's absolutely true, actually. So it's very much a part of the makeup of society, and Christians are an important part of that society and generally have been accepted as such alongside other members of the community.
Okay, so what did you see before Christmas? I mean, certainly every night on the news here, we were getting these awful tales of civilians being attacked by the Syrian Arab army in Aleppo.
Yes, well, I was in Aleppo before Christmas, and it was a deeply profound experience. I was in there actually as the city was liberated, as the vast majority of people saw it. From the last pockets of rebel, so-called rebel resistance. Most of whom are terrorist groups, extremist terrorist groups. I visited East Aleppo. I visited areas. I visited the refugee centres for the people coming out of East Aleppo. And in fact, the stories that the people were telling were a complete contradiction of what we were being told in the Western media. We spent a few hours at reception centres where people had come from East Aleppo just days before, and they were coming and they were telling how the rebels had been committing murders, killing anybody who opposed them or showed any signs of supporting the government, firing on men, women, and children who were trying to flee, withholding food or trying to sell food at exorbitant prices they couldn't afford, withholding medical aid, torture, imprisonment, all these things and rape. These stories were coming consistently from the people, and they were so happy to be out of it. And when the city was declared to be free, not only was the vast majority of the city, of course, is West Aleppo, which was being bombarded constantly by the terrorists themselves, which we didn't read about, and is the majority of the population of the city, they were celebrating in the streets when the last pockets were cleared. But so actually were the vast majority of citizens coming out of those areas who were delighted to be freed from the terrorist occupation. So the narratives we've been getting have been extremely one-sided, and actually in some cases downright misleading, to put it mildly.
Well, look, Andrew, I found it very easy to get hold of you and get you on this programme. Have you been on things like Channel 4 News? Because as someone who's British and obviously quite reliable and has just been in the middle of the war zone, I would have hoped that anyway the mainstream media would have embraced you and listened to your tale.
No, I did. I contacted Channel 4 from Aleppo because there were no British journalists there. There was not one international media agency visiting the reception centres, talking to the tens of thousands of refugees coming out of East Aleppo and listening to their stories, which were contradicting the mainstream media. I contacted Channel 4. I got no reply. I contacted the BBC. The BBC local television gave me 2 minutes and cut me off as soon as I mentioned the stories of the refugees coming, which are contradicting mainstream media. And I was on a local radio station. They gave me a few minutes and tried to steer me away from the message that I was actually trying to convey. And what I'm conveying is not my opinion or my view. It's actually the voices of the people on the ground. And this is one of the most important things that we have to hear is, I believe that over the past months and indeed years, we have not been listening to the people of Syria themselves, the people inside Syria. We've been listening almost exclusively to the views of highly, highly unreliable sources, exclusively in the terrorist groups. And now that many of those areas have been freed, have cleared, and civilians have been able to come back and be freed from that, they're telling what actually went on. It's quite different to what we've been informed. That doesn't mean to say that there wasn't bombing. I saw the bombing of the last area of East Aleppo, and it was quite horrific to behold. But I was glad to hear that actually most of the civilians had left that area the day before, so that particularly intense bombing that I witnessed was mostly the terrorist groups that were left. But what we mustn't forget is that for the last 4 years in Aleppo, West Aleppo has been constantly bombarded by missiles and hellfire cannon, which have been launching death and destruction on schools and hospitals and individuals as well. But we don't hear about that. We haven't been hearing about that.
How does your faith inform your interpretation of events over there?
My faith is about listening. First of all, I think as a people of faith, we've got to listen to people and love, okay? It's at the heart of it is loving and listening to people of all communities, particularly those who are suffering. Now, my knowledge of Syria over quite a number of years now, over many visits and meeting all the communities, is that the realities on the ground haven't been reported. And what I wanted to do was go and stand in solidarity with the suffering communities of all communities and to listen to the voices of the people. But it's also important that we take a prophetic voice as well. And when people in positions of power are using their own political agendas and causing horrendous suffering in the process, the Christian communities have a responsibility to stand up and say, stop, is this right? It's important to stand up and be counted, if you like. But as a Christian, to stand alongside those multiple Christian communities in Syria, and also the other people of faith, the other Muslim communities of faith who've been living alongside the Christian communities for millennia, let alone centuries.
Well, the people of Syria and yourself, what do you think's the real reason behind? I mean, there's obviously been some sort of attempt at regime change, something along the lines maybe of what's happened in countries like Libya to happen in Syria. What do you and the people of Syria think is really behind that attempt?
I think most Syrians, I mean, it's much more international agenda. Frankly, I don't think our governments care much about human rights or human conditions. I don't think that's the agenda behind it at all. I think it's much bigger agendas. It's about the wider political axes and wider political influences and agendas and interests. There are religious elements within it as well. But it's a much bigger political picture. We're very good at wanting regime change when it suits our economic or political interests, whereas other countries, and at the same time, we're seen as hugely hypocritical. I mean, they look at, Syrians look at our alliance with Saudi Arabia, for example, which has a far, far worse human rights record than Syria ever had, and is bombing Yemen to smithereens with our weapons, and we're seen as absolutely hypocritical. our absolute one-sidedness with Israel over the Palestinians and so forth.
It's okay. It's a bit frustrating, isn't it? I mean, you know, do you think it has a very much affect this? Because, I mean, we'll be discussing a story after we finish talking to you, Andrew, about the way that Turkey is turning away from NATO and the United States and more towards the Russians. Also, the same exact thing is happening in the Philippines, where the people in the Philippines have decided actually that they've had enough, really, of dealing with the United States over many years, many decades of US control of the Philippines. Do you think eventually that hypocrisy you've been describing there filters down to change people's, you know, once I suppose the British and the Americans and the West generally loses the battle for hearts and minds?
Well, I've seen this. I've been traveling from the Middle East, as I said, for 30 years, and I've seen the change in attitudes towards the people in the West. And this has been largely because of the actions and the policies of the West in the region itself. Causing chaos, mayhem, destruction, and utter chaos in the region in so many levels, and never learning, and then arming brutal groups and siding with, you know, I mean, it's just been appalling what the positions we've taken. So yes, I think there is a change. I think you're right. I think people in the region, there's a shift in alliances, whether we like it or not. And obviously in the West, we don't like it. But actually, the West has played an appalling role in helping to destroy so many countries, actually, and just does not seem to learn.
Now, does faith actually manage to survive in these war zones? Because I would imagine that many people are looking at a war situation, particularly in the towns and the cities of places like Syria, and thinking, you know, dear God, surely you can't allow this to go on. And actually, it may be a falling away of faith.
Actually, quite the opposite. I think it is so profoundly inspiring and moving to witness and to see. You know that for example, in the churches, yes, okay, it's estimated that about only a quarter of the Christian population are still there from those that were there before the conflict, and yet the dedication of those people to their faith, both the Christians and the Muslims, is quite inspiring to behold. The local communities are doing enormous amounts of work to serve the internally displaced. Remember that there are 6.9 million internally displaced people inside Syria. That's more than all the refugees outside Syria combined. And they're being looked after by the Syrian government, by the Syrian Red Crescent, by the Syrian people, by the communities themselves. And the people of faith are holding to that faith. And as I said, I came back from Aleppo and I spent a couple of days in Damascus after I'd been in Aleppo, which was a shocking experience, seeing the devastation there. And yet even in Aleppo, I saw people saying, you know, we stand by our faith and we want to go back to our homes, we want to rebuild our lives, we want to rebuild Syria, we want to maintain the plurality and diversity of our country, and we want to see this faith reestablished. And as I said, in Damascus, the celebrations of Christmas were going on, and people were going out to the restaurants, and there was Christmas music being played, and Christians and Muslims together celebrating that. Even in Aleppo, I saw that. And tremendous resilience in the country. And that's something that we could learn from, actually.
Now, maybe you could untangle for us some of the different rebel groups, because obviously we've heard about ISIS and we've heard about the so-called Syrian opposition, what used to be the Free Syrian Army, also al-Nusra, who are supposed to be the sort of franchisees for al-Qaeda over there. And then there's the Syrian Arab Army, which is the official government force, as well as the Russians, I suppose, flying around in the air. And I think this is one of the things that, a bit like in the Balkan crisis, many people get kind of bogged down because there seem to be so many different groups. No one knows who's fighting who.
Yeah, I think, well, there's truth in that. I mean, it's said that there's something like 1,500 different factions fighting in Syria. Many of them, of course, are not Syrian. There are numerous foreign fighters from 80, I believe, 80 different countries are represented in the fighting factions in Syria. Yes, you have the opposition forces. The Free Syrian Army, which was sort of formed in 2011, 2012. Most Syrians actually say they don't exist. I mean, they've just been swamped now. You ask a Syrian, and I'm talking about whether they're Sunni or Shia or Christian or whatever, inside Syria, about moderate rebels, and they say there's no such thing, they're all the same, because they've coalesced these multiple different groups. The most important one, of course, is Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a al-Qaeda affiliation, which seems to sort of lead the way. It was certainly leading the way around Aleppo, and currently in Wadi Barada outside Damascus as well. And underneath that, you've got other groups, smaller groups like Ara al-Sham and Jaish al-Islam, which are basically al-Qaeda affiliated to terrorist groups. They're brutal. To call any of these moderate is beyond belief, frankly. They've proven to have committed massacres, beheadings, killing, in the most brutal ways. Then you've got ISIS, which is another extreme. And fighting these multiple groups, yes, you've got the Syrian Arab Army, which, remember, are the sons and the daughters and the husbands and the wives of the Syrians themselves. The Syrian Arab Army is often called Assad's forces. It's not Assad's forces. It's the government of the country, the army of the country, who are Syrians. In fact, most of the Syrian Arab Army are Sunnis. And of course, there are different forces within the Syrian Arab Army. And then you have, of course, the Russians, who are very present. You've got Hezbollah, who are from Lebanon, and they're supporting the Syrian and the Iranians. Although I haven't knowingly seen any Iranians on the ground. I have seen Russians on the ground, and actually Russians are helping tremendously with the refugees and providing medical and food aid to the refugees, the internally displaced refugees in Syria. So yes, you have multiple fighting forces, which are complicated.
Now, Russia today has just announced that it will be withdrawing armed forces from Syria, starting with an aircraft carrier group. Do you think their job there is mostly over then?
I doubt it. I mean, I think it's an aircraft carrier. I mean, the aircraft carrier only arrived a few weeks ago. The Russians are pretty well ensconced, I think, for the moment. When they say start withdrawing, I think start is probably the word of emphasis there. But I doubt their work is finished. And the war isn't over by any means. And who knows where it's going to be.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll put a link up on our show page to a website called South Front, which is regular maps of who controls what bits of Syria. But I'll tell you what we'll do now, if you can hold on with us a minute, Andrew, because we're going to have a listen now to a US point of view on Syria. And this is the BBC's Gordon Carrera speaking earlier this week to the CIA director John Brennan, and he's got a lot of advice for the Trump administration, which is going to be taking over in 2 weeks' time. And of course, John Brennan has actually been sacked by Donald Trump, so some would say he's been causing a few difficulties before he goes. But let's have a listen to for a couple of minutes now to Gordon Carrera from the BBC interviewing John Brennan on the subject, the very subject that we've been talking about just now, Syria.
But it must be quite frustrating to watch what's happening in Aleppo.
Very frustrating.
And know that there's not much, it appears, that the United States can do about it.
Very frustrating.
And you don't think there's much more that could be done?
I think there
is. To intervene or in some way to support those groups?
I do believe that the Russians hold a real key to Syria's future. And unfortunately, I think they have pursued their interests, their national interests, and the interests of the Assad government to the detriment of the people of Syria. And this, unfortunately, has resulted in the destruction of a large part of the beautiful country of Syria and the death of countless Syrians, with Bashar Assad's direction. He is responsible for most of those deaths.
Sounds like you're quite skeptical about the idea of doing a deal with the Russians to change the situation.
We've tried to do a deal with the Russians over the last several months since the cessation of hostilities was forged earlier this year. And we have tried to restrain the opposition groups that the United States government supports. I do not see the Russians restraining the Syrians. I think the Russians and the Syrians have taken advantage of any pauses in fighting to advance their position on the battlefield. And I think that is intentional on their part. They've been disingenuous in many of their negotiating tactics. So I do not have confidence that the Russians are going to relent until they are able to achieve as much tactical battlefield successes as possible in order to give them what they want in terms of their ultimate strategic aims.
Well, that's the outgoing CIA Director John Brennan there speaking to the BBC's Gordon Carrera earlier this week. But we're joined on the line by Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who's just returned from Syria a couple of weeks ago, just before Christmas he was there. Andrew, what did you make of what John Brennan is saying there?
Normal line, it's a standard line. The situation on the ground, the reason I've been to Syria several times is because the situation on the ground is actually very different. First of all, yes, the destruction has been vast. What's really interesting in Aleppo, though, remember that, first of all, Aleppo is a divided city. The vast majority of the population live in Western government-controlled Aleppo, and the rebels have controlled the eastern part of the city, and that has been largely destroyed. But the destruction is not largely from the air, from bombs. When you go to the sites, when you go to the cities that have been destroyed, largely the areas that have been largely destroyed, you find that actually most of the destruction is street level. Most of it is street level fighting, which by the witness of the people themselves has happened between many factions, of course, and with the fighting of the Syrian army as well. So yes, there has been bombing, and you see the evidence of that, but far, far greater was on-the-ground destruction. Now, on the ground in Syria, remember the vast amount of the majority of the population of Syria in Syria still live in government-controlled areas. If you talk to those people, people won't like to hear this, but actually they'd regard the Russians as heroes. I've seen trucks, a whole line of Russian trucks taking aid to the internally displaced in Aleppo. They're cheered. They're providing medical equipment and aid. And a lot of the people of Syria see the rebels, the so-called rebels, as multiple extremist fighting factions with a brutal ideology, most Syrians of which do not support and do not want to see Syria become an Islamic State, which is a declared intention of most of our so-called moderate rebels' allies. They want to see a Syria that is plural, as democratic as possible, diverse, and not dependent on an extreme ideology, which most of these groups represent.
And so you don't think then that John Brennan's right when he says that what the Russians have been doing is to the detriment of the people of Syria? That's what he's just said there. And he's saying that they support, the Pentagon, supports the opposition groups.
Well, of course, that's clear. The Americans do, and so do the British, which is absurd. I'm not saying that the Assad government is perfect. I'm not saying that bad things haven't happened in a war. Bad things happen on all sides, and all sides are guilty of things. But what I'm saying is that actually to say that, you know, the Syrian people want to see the interests of the so-called rebels prevail is a total and absolute nonsense. The Syrian, most of the Syrian people, who the majority are still, I stress, in government-controlled areas, support the Syrian army, and actually are really appreciated the Russians, who they regard as their saviors, because in fact Russia did, in 2015, pretty well prevent the fall of Damascus to rebel forces. I'm afraid the so-called rebels certainly do not represent the wishes of the Syrian people.
Yeah, but you see what? Hang on, sorry to interrupt you there, Andrew. But you see what the CIA director John Brennan is saying is that the Russians are only really doing this in their own interest. They've got strategic interests in Syria.
Of course. Yes, I mean, yeah, I don't doubt that. In the same way that, you know, do we really think that the British government and the Americans are interested in the human interests of Syria? Do you think that we aren't acting in our own strategic interests?
I suppose you're right. But what do you think about what's motivating these fighters, these jihadi groups? Because they seem to think that they're actually following the Quran and somehow kind of creating a caliphate.
Well, yes. I mean, the extremists certainly, you know, sort of they're indoctrinated to think that. That's not, I have to say, from my experience in Syria over many years, that's not the view of most Syrian Muslims within Syria. They don't hold to that view at all. And that's most Syrians, including many Sunni Syrians, are absolutely appalled by that ideology and do not hold to it at all. As I said, if you go to talk to many Sunnis in Syria, they do not support these extremist rebel groups at all. Of course, there are political interests that they've been fighting about, but the religious ideology is an obscene ideology.
Yeah, do you think maybe religion has been being used? Maybe, someone would say that it was in Northern Ireland as well, for example, but do you think you've seen that in Syria?
Absolutely. I think the religious sectarian interests have been used and abused, in order to fuel the conflict and the interests of different communities. Everybody's got interests. I think you've got to acknowledge that. You can't sort of accuse one party of having interests when everybody has interests, I think the faith issues have been stoked by certain groups in different ways.
How would you, before we say goodbye, could you just leave us with your thoughts about how we should interpret what we see on mainstream media in order to try and get to the truth? Or where is it not worth bothering with that? Should we go to get stuff from the internet, for example?
I think that you have to look around. I'm consistently appalled by the mainstream media. I've been visiting the Middle East, as I say, for 30 years, and rarely have I seen the mainstream media reflecting a genuine, accurate, and fair picture across the region, to be honest, and Syrian reporting has been absolutely diabolical. And as a regular visitor to Syria prior to the conflict and during the conflict, I can say it barely reflects realities on the ground. It's been profoundly twisted and misrepresentative. But yes, I think you need to look at different news media and also online. And I think that there's a lot going about on the social media. And yes, there's a lot of rubbish out there as well. But getting different perspectives is important. There are multiple perspectives. There are multiple narratives, and no one narrative contains the whole truth. We've been fed one sole narrative for 5 years now, a lot of it twisted and a lot from very dodgy sources. We have to look around. I want to just finish, if I've just got 30 seconds. The three messages that have come from the Syrian people. Now, what I say, I often say, what my view is not important. I don't really care what my view is. What I care about is the people of Syria and their voices, which is why I've been to Syria, to listen to their voices. And what I share is their voices, not mine. Their message is threefold. First of all, their cry to the Western community is to stop supporting terrorism. Frankly, most of the so-called moderates we support are terrorist groups affiliated to brutal terrorist organizations. Stop supporting all terrorism. Stop supporting all arms. End the fighting. Two, listen to the people of Syria. Now, I've met with all the internal opposition leaders in Syria, and they say, why is the world listening to all these exiles who haven't been in Syria for 15 years, whatever reason, and they're the voices that represent Syria? No, they don't. The people inside Syria represent Syria. Listen to the people inside Syria. We hardly ever hear voices from inside Syria, the people on the ground, actually, what they're saying. And thirdly, talk to all parties to exclude, whether you like him or not, to exclude the president of the country, which on a major perspective, on a genuine perspective, by international law has been protecting his country from international terrorism, on another perspective. You can't exclude the president of the country, whether you like him or not. You've got to include all Syrian parties.
Well, it's worth mentioning as well, isn't it, that Assad won an election 2 years ago with something like 86% of the vote.
Yes, and actually, that's been ridiculed, of course, in the Western media. But actually, there were observers to watch there, and the observers who were there said actually that was perfectly fair. And when you talk to people on the ground, actually, that does reflect the kind of thing you get on the ground. People are critical in all sorts of ways, but actually, its popularity remains very, very strong. And what the Syrians say is, who is the international community to say, declare who or who is not going to govern Syria? We as Syrians, it's up to the Syrians to decide who leads them, not us or the Americans or the Syrian opposition in Turkey, who are mostly Muslim Brotherhood, who most of the Syrians in Syria don't like. It's up to the Syrians inside Syria to decide their future.
Reverend Andrew Ashdown, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much indeed, and God bless.
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, Martin, bit of a contrast there between what we heard from the CIA director, John Brennan, still just about for the next 2 weeks, and Reverend Andrew Ashdown.
Yes, well, I know who I believe. And I suspect many people, if they listen to what we've just heard fairly, should know what they believe.
He's painting a really, actually, what is an entirely shocking picture there. He's saying effectively that all of the London media, the TV, the radio and the newspapers have been effectively providing cover for some of the most hideous terrorists in the world.
Well, I mean, we've been saying this on this show for years now.
He's irreverent using the word diabolical to describe it.
Well, it is diabolical, isn't it? And don't forget that Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister under Mitterrand, not under Sarkozy, he's on the record on French TV as saying that before the uprising started, he was approached by British officials who said, "We are going to run an armed uprising in Syria." Now, in other words, Britain is in the frame for starting this war in which at least 500,000 people have died.
That was under your Labour, David Miliband. He was Foreign Secretary at the time.
Yes, he was. And David Miliband, in fact, has been going on about how he's been tweeting about how people are being raped and murdered in eastern Aleppo, even though he's based in New York. Where he got that information from, we can probably guess. Probably from the same sources, the White Helmets, etc. We have been involved in wrecking that country. Our armed forces, like the SAS, have been training Al-Qaeda. Can we come back to this point? We've supposedly been having a war against Al-Qaeda because they supposedly carried out the 9/11 attack. We've had 15 years. We've invaded Afghanistan. We've invaded Iraq. We've invaded Libya. We've supported we've gone all over the world doing this. And now we've got the White Helmets embedded with Al-Qaeda in eastern Aleppo, acting as their PR, funded by the British government. And of course, the terrorists themselves, Al-Qaeda, being trained by the SAS. Now, that's the reality that people have got to face up to. Al-Qaeda is our creation, not just our creation in the 1980s, our current creation. And if we want to defeat Al-Qaeda, maybe we have to start knocking down some British Army generals.
What about the assertion that he's making there, though, about the media? Because this does seem to be one of the main things, is he's really railing against the fact that we're just getting a completely distorted picture where the media, almost all the time, the mainstream press from London, has been backing these terrorists.
Well, indeed. And don't forget, we've got to the Brigade 77, which is a part of the British Army, which spends all of its time on social media essentially spreading lies about what's going on. I sent you an article this week, which was published in The Guardian in 2011, I think, when the rebels had just appeared in Aleppo. And they interviewed, this was when Western media were still reporting from the ground. And they interviewed a local rebel commander, and he said, "Well, the problem in Aleppo is that 70% of the population don't support us." And that would be a problem, wouldn't it, for a guerrilla army? Aleppo was one of the parts of Syria where they had least support. It was a prosperous middle-class city with a mixed population, and they were quite happy as they were. And the rebels turned up and said, "No, we're going to have a war to create a caliphate here," supported by the Americans and the British.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that Donald Trump has decided he's had enough of the CIA director, John Brennan, reported on National Public Radio in the US. He gave another interview. The head of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Brennan, said in an interview with NPR, "Bloodshed in Syria was partially because of their role in the war. I think we always like to say that we wish where we would have been able to make a difference in a way that would have prevented the slide and the situation there," Director John Brennan said in an interview with NPR. "There's no way you can divorce yourself emotionally or mentally from these situations that you play a role in," Brennan said, adding that he felt some responsibility for the horrific bloodshed.
Well, what he means by that is we should have bombed some more. I mean, John Kerry this week said, who was Obama's, you know, the Secretary of State, said that he blamed Britain for us not going to war in 2011.
Well, Brennan carries on, "This insurgency is not going to go away until there's some type of viable and genuine political process that will bring to power in Damascus a government that is representative of the Syrian people," Brennan said.
Well, it's just more blah, blah, blah. In 2011, the Syrians had an election which Assad won overwhelmingly. and in actual fact Assad is emerging as a major figure both in Syrian, Middle Eastern and world politics. He and his lovely wife Asma Assad, both of whom were brought up in Britain and speak perfect English, are regarded in many parts of the of Syria and elsewhere as on a par with somebody like Abraham Lincoln. They've held the country together. They've squashed a racist rebellion by slave-owning jihadis. And not only and you know what? If you're up against that sort of opposition, maybe there is no point talking to them. Maybe the Russians are wrong here to call a ceasefire. I'm sure that won't be very popular on the ground in Syria. They say, well, hang on a minute. But the Russians, in fact, are playing a mediating role. They're trying to say if they can find somebody to talk to that's worth talking to. But if I was an ordinary Syrian, I'd say, to hell with that. Let's kill them all off and get rid of them, including their British Army and US Army backers. They've got to be made to pay a price as well. They need to be sent home in body bags, don't they?
Martin, one of the things that the mainstream press just do not report is the number of foreign fighters in there. They're really not Syrians fighting. The US road map to Balkanized Syria is an excellent article by Pepe Escobar back in September. He's dug out some Defense Intelligence Agency document which was declassified in May last year from 2012. It says it talks about the empire of chaos's real agenda in Syria. That's his words. He says, quoting from the document, he said, the West, Gulf countries and Turkey, who support the Syrian opposition, is the possibility of establishing a declared or undeclared Salafist principality in eastern Syria. And this is exactly what the supporting powers to the opposition want in order to isolate the Syrian regime, which is considered the strategic depth of the Shia expansion in Iraq and Iran.
Well, what he's hinting at there is the role, strategic interests of Israel, which have also also been involved in this as well.
We've talked a lot about this.
It's not just the British generals and US generals that need to go home in body bags. It's also Israeli generals as well, isn't it?
We've talked about this Balkanization of the Middle East planned by Oded Yinon, haven't we?
Yeah, the Yinon plan came out in the 1980s. Said we want to Balkanize all of our neighbours through creating civil wars in their countries.
There's one great hypocrisy.
And that's exactly what they've done.
One great hypocrisy here, which is that we're talking about terrorists. The whole definition of terrorist is about a non-state actor, and yet actually it looks as if the West has been backing terrorism to a massive extent.
Well, of course they have. They've been backing them all the way. And what Syria shows me is that the pretense that Al-Qaeda, which was set up by the Western intelligence services with the cooperation of the Saudis in the 1980s to kill Russian conscripts in Afghanistan, and then they said, oh, Al-Qaeda's gone rogue, we've lost control of it, they've carried out 9/11, what can we do? I think that they've been in control of it all along. I think the Saudi intelligence services, working with the British, the Americans and the Israelis, have controlled Al-Qaeda from the get-go, and they still control them today. They've got to be defeated. Al-Qaeda must be defeated. I'm not a pacifist. Let's defeat them.
Let's go north a little bit to look at Turkey, because last weekend, over New Year's, there was a horrific attack on a nightclub there. Although there seems to be immediately completely conflicting information coming out about how many attackers there were. For one example, on BBC World News, they had one of the people who was hiding in the nightclub and managed to survive on there, saying that she saw either two or three attackers, and yet all the mainstream press is saying there's only one guy, and we think we know who he is, and we're now after him.
Well, in Turkey, over many years, people are very well aware that the deep state involves itself in false flag terrorism. It's a fact of life. Top US Turkish generals were sent to prison by the Erdogan regime when it first came to power some while ago because they were convicted of carrying out terrorist attacks, which made to look like Islamist attacks, made to look like left-wing attacks, made to look like Islamist attacks. And it's a fact of life. That's what goes on.
Okay.
That's the real world.
Also, the US warned Turkey of potential ISIL attack over Christmas, says and the New Year, says the US government sources anyway. The message titled Security Message for US Citizens New Year's Eve Celebration also urged US citizens to be mindful of this when deciding to attend public gatherings for New Year's Eve celebrations in Turkey.
Well, one of the suspicions must be, knowing what we know, that the assassination of the Russian ambassador and the attack on this nightclub, which was half full of foreigners, these could be carried out by the same NATO intelligence services, the Israelis and the Saudis, who've been backing the terrorists on the other side of the border in Syria. And I'm pretty sure that plenty of Turkish police officers will be very well aware of that possibility.
Meanwhile, looking west a little bit, the US has sent 3,600 tanks against Russia, and a massive NATO deployment is underway. This is Operation Atlantic Resolve. It's in full swing. 2,000 American tanks are being sent in coming days from Germany to Eastern Europe, and 1,600 tanks are being deployed to storage facilities in the Netherlands. At the same time, NATO countries are sending thousands of soldiers in towards the Russian borders. According to US Army Europe, 4,000 troops and 2,000 tanks will arrive in three US transport ships to Germany next weekend. From Bremerhaven, US troops and a huge amount of military material will be going to Poland and other countries in Central and Eastern Europe.
Well, what's happening is that the CIA and others in the deep state in the US are trying to create a situation where, whatever Donald Trump may think, he is going to have to continue the policy of confrontation with Russia, and also, you know, the wars to obtain power in the Middle East. And of course, Trump's a deeply contradictory figure, because he talks out of one side of his mouth about building a better relationship with Russia, and on the other side of his mouth, he supports the far right in Israel, who've got no interest in peace whatsoever, and he wants to provoke a war with the Chinese. So very dangerous times we live in. And of course, the deep state in the US is trying to, is the one positive aspect of his policy, they're trying to sabotage it. And that's what this is about.
Okay, what about Russian warships docking in the Philippines on a goodwill visit? And we've got a little bit of audio on that as well, actually, this week. Russia is offering the Philippines close relations. And you're going to hear now a report which was on CNN Philippines this week. The reporter David Santos speaking to and recording the Russian ambassador to the Philippines, Igor Govayetsk.
Russian Ambassador Igor Kovayev speaking to the media Wednesday on board Admiral Tributes, the Russian warship on port call in Manila this week. Moscow is ready to work with Manila in addressing threats to security and sustainable development.
We are ready to supply the Philippines with sophisticated arms and weapons. Russia has a lot to offer. But everything will be done in full compliance with the international law.
By diversification, Kovayev was referring to the need for the country to look beyond traditional partners such as the United States. The ambassador had strong words against the U.S. when asked about allegations Russia meddled in the U.S. presidential election through cyber attacks. In response, he dismissed the accusations, calling them mere rumors.
The most powerful country complains about interference from a weak Russia. So it means that the United States he looks like a banana republic, which is not able to defend your election system from interference from abroad.
Describing Russia as a reliable defense partner, Kovayev cites their relations with longtime ally Vietnam. He says Vietnam never accused Russia of interfering in domestic affairs throughout its close to seven-decade-old alliance.
We never use military cooperation as a kind of political leverage on our partners.
Kovayev repeatedly assured the country that Russia would be a credible partner. He said the prejudice on Russia should be set aside. Perhaps to show that all is well, the Russian government hosted a dinner for Philippine officials on board its warship, a sign of better things to come between the two countries. David Santos, CNN Philippines.
Yes, thanks, David Santos, CNN Philippines. Amazing, really, Martin. It looks like the Philippines has floated away from America and floated in towards Russia. Igor Govayev there accusing the Americans of accusing the Russians of hacking his elections. They say, well, are you some kind of banana republic?
Well, yes. I mean, there's an awful lot going on as we speak. I mean, this is the first week of 2017, and, you know, the tectonic plates are in movement.
The Americans have been struggling to control the Philippines for decades and decades. It looks
well,
like
they had their own. They had their. Remember Aquino, the dictator that ran the Philippines for years on behalf of the Americans? And, of course, lots of people in the Philippines were. Aquino was later. Marcos, yeah. And, you know, people remember that.
Imelda Marcos and her famous
Her famous shoes. I mean, we are not regarded, when the CIA say, we say so-and-so's happening, and you know you can trust us, we think, well, hang on, what do we know about the CIA? What we know as historical fact about the CIA is that you've overthrown democratic regimes all over the world, in Chile, in Brazil, in Southeast Asia. You've lied and cheated and murdered and killed. And actually, you might think that the Americans at this stage of the game might say, well, we're disbanding the CIA because they've got such a bad reputation. station, we're going to set something else up which is new, and therefore we won't have to use those horrible initial CIA. They were involved in drug dealing in the Iran-Contra affair and so on. Now, in other words, they are not credible sources of information. They're professional liars. They always have been.
Well, the CNN reporter David Santos there mentioned the hacking, as did the Russian ambassador to the Philippines, Igor Govayev. And that was a subject that cropped up when Gordon Carrera from the BBC had a chat to John Brennan.
Russia was engaged in the attacks on these networks to collect information, and then there was information that was released through various mechanisms on the internet.
Through WikiLeaks.
Yes, and it came out in a number of ways, and with the purpose of trying to influence the outcome. I will defer to my domestic counterparts to make a determination about whether or not things happened here domestically. I just know that from an intelligence perspective, Russia was engaged in this type of activity with a particular purpose in mind and an intent, and they were able to carry that out. The consequences and impact of that are something that I will leave to others.
Did you have any conversations with Russian counterparts about it, to challenge them over it?
Yes.
What did you tell them?
I said that this effort would backfire, that the U.S. people hold dear the democratic principles of this great country, and one of the most important tenets of this democracy is a free and fair election for our president, and that it's important for this country and for the citizens of this country to know that their election is not going to be influenced or affected by outside parties.
Do you think the warnings to Russia worked? Because I think there were some communicated through October. Do you think they actually had an impact in perhaps preventing something happening on election day?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Did you see a change of behavior, do you think, in the cyber realm after that?
Again, I would defer to my domestic counterparts, because they would be the ones with responsibility for determining what actually was taking place on U.S. soil.
What do you think the best way is of dealing with this quite aggressive Russian posture in cyberspace? I mean, cyber espionage has been going on for decades, but the release of information, kind of information warfare, what the Russians call active measures, they seem to be pushing the boundaries of that. Some people suggest that the way to respond is to do the same back. Do you think that's an effective way of dealing with it?
No, I don't think we should stoop to their level. But I think what we need to do is to make sure that they understand that engaging in these activities is unacceptable, and that there should be costs that will be incurred if they do this. And I know that the United States government has looked at various ways to determine how those costs might be levied. What you don't want to do is to engage in something that's going to lead to a spiraling
escalation
of these types of attacks. But this is where I think the U.S. government, along with our foreign partners, needs to really be thinking about how we're going to deal with this digital domain, where you can really wreak quite a bit of havoc and damage if countries, and particularly governments, do not adhere to some norms and standards, things that they will not do. This requires, I think, a very robust and broad-based discussion, not just with our foreign allies and partners, but also with other countries, such as Russia and China. And we've had those discussions. There cannot just be a free rein given to countries in terms of what they are able to do in that digital domain. We are facing enough challenges with hacktivist groups and others who can ply their trade in those environments.
It's Gordon Carrera from the BBC speaking to the CIA's outgoing director, John Brennan. Martin, aggressive Russian posture in cyberspace.
Well, it's just pot calling the kettle black, isn't it? There's no evidence. He didn't produce any evidence that the Russians have hacked the election. And of course, what they said is that they hacked Podesta's emails, and then they said, and then WikiLeaks said, no, we actually got it from a leak. And they said, oh yes, but the Russians must have leaked it. So they've actually got, they can't even get the story straight.
In The Guardian, this is Owen Jones, saying the Americans could spot election meddling because they've been doing it for years.
Well, they certainly have, including in their own country. Are US elections free and fair? The answer is no, but it's not the Russians.
Also, I mentioned at the top of the hour, we'll be having another look at Operation Gladio. We do that reasonably regularly, but there's another book out about it by the US author and journalist Paul Williams.
It remains a massive, massive undertaking. Operation Gladio, in a nutshell, began with the creation of the CIA the United States was determined to stem the spread of communism throughout Europe, especially in Italy, where over 60% of the people were communist. And they were afraid of a communist takeover. And we started setting up and funding Stay Behind armies. A lot of them were Nazi armies. Stay Behind to combat a possible Soviet invasion of Europe. And to fund that operation, you got to realize the scope of this. They were in every country in Europe. And I'm not talking about 10 or 100. I'm talking thousands of Stay Behind armies that had to be funded by us to stem and also to do away with any communist demonstrations and to subvert places, organizations like the Red Brigades. Gladio was all of that. And it ended up, and to right now, it ended up in the hands of people who want to control the natural resources of countries throughout the world. The gladiators right now, we're still at the control of Gladio, or in Syria, or in the Middle East, or in the Ukraine. I mean, it's all a Gladio operation. Almost everything that you see, it hasn't gone away. I mean, you cannot understand the world today without coming to terms with Gladio and the people behind Gladio, who are now the international bankers and the global businessmen, that community. You really can't have any idea what's taking place, especially in a place like Syria, without coming to terms with Gladio. We've been subjected to so many false flag attacks ourselves. For instance, one thing with Gladio that stands out is the Gulf of Tonkin. In 1967, LBJ appeared on national TV, and he preempted all broadcast, and he said there's been a major attack on the U.S. fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin, and it was an attack by the North Vietnamese, and that there are hundreds of dead sailors, their bodies are floating in the Gulf, and it's an act of war, and we have to respond. And therefore, we have that massive a military buildup and escalation of the Vietnamese conflict that, of course, ended up in complete chaos. But once again, that was a false flag attack. It never happened. Our fleet was never fired on in the Gulf of Tonkin. It was all made up. But throughout Italy, in particular during the 1970s, false flag attack mounted on false flag attack upon false flag attack. That was all blamed on the communists. And they were really perpetuated by the CIA. When you look at our history of false flag attacks and realize that, I mean, this is our heritage, you got to look really with a very cold eye at 9/11. I mean, was that a false flag attack? You got to realize that the source, the funding of all the CIA's operations, and this came out in the Kerry Commission before the Senate.
Okay, we have to finish there. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Horfield, Ollie Mead. Also, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Our show page for your comments and criticisms this week, .org.uk. I'm on Twitter, at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless you. And don't let the banksters get you down.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, a gunman's opened fire at Fort Lauderdale Airport in southeast Florida, reportedly killing 3 people and injuring several others. The shooting happened in a baggage claim area at one of the terminals. NBC News claims the gunman's been arrested. Donald Trump has dismissed the controversy over alleged Russian hacking in the presidential election race as a political witch hunt. He's meeting intelligence officials who will present evidence of interference by Moscow. Republican commentator Jan Halper-Hayes explains.